welcome you all to our last of our Spring 94 IBRI colloquium sessions. IBRI is our acronym for the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. We're involved here in biblical and in various other parts of the country, actually, although most of our guys are around here, trying to strengthen the church in outreach to unbelievers, outreach particularly intellectuals, trying to encourage in those areas, in the area of strengthening the church, both in trying to figure out how to approach such people and trying to know what to say to them, things of that sort as well. For our topic this evening, Dr. Charles Zimmerman here at Biblical is going to be giving a talk on leadership and change. Dr. Zimmerman always draws big crowds to the IBRI sessions. That's often because he dismisses a class and tells them that if they want a good grade, they need to show up here. We'll appreciate your prayers for this weekend. Perry Phillips and myself and John Studenroth will be over in North Jersey in Basking Ridge, New Jersey, at Millington Baptist Church, giving a seminar on evidence for faith. And if you're over in that area and want to drop in on us, about $50, there's some brochures up here at the front to advertise that for you, too. But even if you can't, we'd appreciate your prayers. Charles, I want to have you come talk to us this evening on leadership and change. You'll put this equipment on.
It really is always a joy to come and do an IBRI session, even though I don't fit the typical profile of an IBRI speaker. I'm not an intellectual. I'm a practitioner. And I have a hard enough time saying what IBRI stands for, so you need to bear with me. Tonight we're going to talk about leadership and change. And if you think interdisciplinary, leadership is really becoming that these days. In fact, that probably is one of the fastest growing and cores of literature coming off the presses today about leadership and management, but particularly leadership. And so as we seek to look at leadership tonight and change, you're going to see that I believe those two things have to go hand in hand. And if there is going to be leadership manifest, then change must be an issue that is dealt with and dealt with in a biblical way. To start, I want to draw some starting points because we're not going to spend a whole lot of time running through the scripture tonight. And so I thought I just wanted to tell you kind of where I'm starting from. You may want to hit those lights, Gordon, if you would. At least this one side. I first of all believe and begin with the assumption that God's truth is unchanging. The Bible's revelation is for every culture, for every language, and for every generation. God's truth, however, comes to us in a cultural container. And you've wrestled with reading through the Old Testament and the New Testament, understanding what is the cultural container and what is the truth. But we would all agree with the basic assumption that God's truth is unchanging and God's truth comes in a cultural container. The task of ministry is really pouring the truth out of the cultural container of the Hebrew-Greek world and pouring it into the cultural container of our day. That, just like hermeneutics, is a science and an art. And we won't say a whole lot more about that. We could actually have a whole session on that, I guess. But God's truth is unchanging, and we're starting from that foundation. Secondly, the church is Christ's body. The church is God's primary vehicle to ensure and to bring about his general ministry objectives in the world. One of my favorite sections of the scripture to turn to look at that is the book of Ephesians. And I just want to read a section from Ephesians chapter 4 that links together what the body of Christ, the church, should have as its objectives and should be moving toward. The whole section here talks about maturity, and the illustration of the body is used, and that's why I phrase our second assumption as I do, the church is Christ's body. Let me begin in verse 11, and I'll read through verse 16. It was he, Christ, who gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, and some to be pastors and teachers. Now here's their purpose: to prepare God's people for works of service so that the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. Then we will no longer be infants tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of men and their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will in all things grow up into Him who is the head, that is Christ. From Him the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. I think we could say that Christ's body has as its primary objective to grow God's people. The focus there is maturity. But I think maturity is mentioned with three different nuanced perspectives. For example, doctrinal maturity is certainly evident, right? You cannot have a church that doesn't have as one of its primary objectives the doctrinal maturity of the members of the church and bringing people in to doctrinal maturity. And so it says things like, no longer am infants tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and the cunning and craftiness of men and their deceitful scheming. Doctrinal maturity. We'll have the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, so forth. That's the one that churches most often emphasize. But that's not the only measure of maturity here in Ephesians 4, and certainly not the only measure of maturity in the Bible. The second is what I want to call relational maturity, and that's hinted at, but it's still evident right here. It says in verse 15, instead speaking the truth in love. If you read the rest of the chapter, when Paul describes what it means to live as children of the light, the doctrine that we've learned and grown up in needs to be lived out in our relationships with other people. And so we manifest the truth that we believe. We don't just become reservoirs for truth. We become living incarnations, if you will, in a relational sense, of that truth. There's another kind of maturity, though. And I call that functional maturity. Look at how that section ends in verse 16. From Him the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, it grows and it builds itself up in love as each part does its work. We began reading tonight with verses 11 and 12 that say, Jesus gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists. God created each of us with a unique role to play in the body. He designed our gift mix, our personality, all of those things differently. And if we are ever going to be the church, we need to help people mature doctrinally, relationally, and functionally, serving in the place that God built them to serve. All three of those things. So that's kind of my working assumption. And number two, the church is Christ's body, and we have as our mission, as members of the church, doctrinal, relational, functional maturity. The third assumption that I want to start from is knowing the Bible is not enough. Now, before you get real nervous here, I think that we all live that way. In fact, if you're familiar with the Westminster Confession, you realize that right in the first chapter of the Westminster Confession, they say a very similar thing. The Bible does not tell us everything we need to know, but the Bible tells us everything we need to live as God calls us to live and to live in ways that honor and glorify Him. But we do need to know other things. We need to know, I would say, other people. We need to know our culture. That knowledge enables us to take the cultural container of Scripture, to empty the truth out of it, and then to repackage it in the cultural container of our day. In 1 Chronicles chapter 12, there's an interesting verse tucked away there that has actually become one of my favorites. It's in a description of David's men, and in verse 32 of 1 Chronicles 12, it describes the men of Issachar, and it says this: the men of Issachar understood the times and knew what Israel should do. You see, it's not just enough to know the Bible, you have to understand your times. You have to understand where you are and where God wants you to be if you're ever going to develop an effective strategy to get from here to there. So if we don't understand where we are and we don't understand where God wants us to be, then we stand little chance of ever getting there. Now, again, you're not there if you know those two things, but you have to know those two things. Just like taking a journey or going on vacation. You have to know where you are on the map. And you have to know where you want to go on the map so that you can pick the right route to take you there. My guess is if you walk into a mall and you see a directory, there'll be a big red arrow somewhere that says, you are here. Why? Because if you don't know where you are, you're probably not going to be able to make the right turns to get you ready to where you want to be. The men of Issachar understood the times. They understood where they were. And I kind of suspect that there are a lot of people seeking to lead churches today. And that's my background. Talking about leadership, I mean, I will use church illustrations because that's kind of my context. But there are a whole lot of people in leadership positions, particularly in the church, that don't know where they are. They're not sure of the cultural container. They're not sure where the people are. And maybe they have a crystal clear definition and target of where God wants them to be, but you stand little chance of ever getting there if you don't know where people are and you don't know where you are. So there are three working assumptions. God's truth is unchanging. The church is Christ's body, but knowing the Bible is not enough. In fact, I often say in counseling, in our intro to counseling class that I also teach here, I often say, ministry is nothing more than hermeneutics. It's interpreting the Bible and interpreting people, and then appropriately applying the Bible to the lives of those people. But until you've interpreted the person, your interpretation of the Bible is meaningless. You need to interpret both, hermeneutics, both sides, and then make the connection between the two appropriately. Well, let's then talk a little bit about our changing world, and this is the first part of your outline. There have been whole studies done and lots of books written lately about our changing world. I just want to read a couple of little things to just underscore the fact that our world is changing probably faster than ever before. Here's a letter that was written a few years ago, as you'll soon tell, and it was addressed to President Jackson. Here's what it says. The canal system of this country is being threatened by the spread of a new form of transportation known as railroads. The federal government must preserve the canals for the following reasons. If canal boats are supplanted by railroads, serious unemployment will result. Captains, cooks, drivers, hostlers, repairmen, and lock tenders will be left without means of livelihood, not to mention the numerous farmers now employed in growing hay for the horses. Boat builders would suffer, and tow line, whip, and harness makers would be left destitute. Canal boats are absolutely essential to the defense of the United States. In the event of the unexpected trouble with England, the Erie Canal would be the only means by which we could ever move supplies vital to waging modern war. As you may well know, Mr. President, railroad carriages are pulled at the enormous speed of 15 miles per hour by engines which, in addition to endangering life and limb of passengers, roar and snort their way through the countryside, setting fire to crops, scaring livestock, and frightening women and children. The Almighty never intended that people should travel at such breakneck speed. Sincerely, Martin Van Buren, Governor of New York. Now, if you watched the news last night and saw the big train wreck, maybe you realize he's right. but we kind of chuckle at that. But my hunch is 10 years from now, we'll be chuckling about some changes that we're really wrestling with, wondering if we can survive if they happen today. But change is going to happen. The question is not if it's going to happen. The question is, what are we going to do with the change? Here was another thing I came across a while ago entitled, For Those Born Before 1945. A few of you, this may be more meaningful to others. Consider the changes that we have witnessed. We were born before television, before penicillin, before polio shots, frozen food, Xerox, plastic, contact lenses, Frisbee, and the pill. We were born before radar, credit cards, split atoms, laser beams, and ballpoint pens. Before pantyhose, dishwashers, clothes dryers, electric blankets, air conditioners, drip-dry clothes, and before anyone ever walked on the moon or thought of it. We got married first and then lived together. How quaint can you be? In our time, closets were for clothes, not for coming out of. Bunnies were small rabbits, and rabbits were not Volkswagens. Designer jeans were scheming girls named Jean. And having a meaningful relationship meant getting along well with our cousins. We thought fast food was what you ate during Lent, and outer space was the back of the Riviera Theater. We were before house husbands, gay rights, computer dating, dual careers, and commuter marriages. We were before daycare centers, group therapy, and nursing homes. We never heard of FM radio, tape decks, electric typewriters, artificial hearts, word processors, and guys wearing earrings. For us, time sharing meant togetherness, not computers or condominiums. A chip was a piece of wood. Hardware was hardware. Software wasn't even a word. In 1940, made in Japan meant junk. And the term making out referred to what you did on your exam. Pizza, McDonald's, and instant coffee were unheard of. We hit the scene when there were 5 and 10 cent stores, where you bought things for 5 and 10 cents. Sanders and Wilson sold ice cream cones for a nickel or a dime. For one nickel, you could ride a streetcar, make a telephone call, buy a Pepsi or enough stamps to mail one letter and two postcards. You could buy a new Chevy coupe for $600, but who could afford one? What a pity, too, for gas was 11 cents a gallon. In our day, cigarette smoking was fashionable. Grass was something you mowed. Coke was a cold drink, and pot was something you cooked in. Rock music was a grandmom's lullaby, and aides were the helpers in the principal office. We were certainly not before the difference between the sexes was discovered, but we were surely before the sex change. We made do with what we had, and we were the last generation that was so dumb as to think you needed a husband to have a baby. No wonder we're so confused. There really is a generation gap. Some of you may have lived through some of that. Change continues to happen. And the rate of speed of change increases all of the time. And that makes life sometimes confusing. Let's talk a little bit about the changing community. We've looked at a couple of anecdotes. The one change that has affected all of us is urbanization. Let me just rattle off some numbers here to you. In 1820, one out of every three people lived in a city in the United States, one out of three. By 1870, In 1820, one out of 13 lived in a city. Can't read my own writing. In 1870, one out of four. In 1970, three out of four lived in a city, and they project that by the year 2000, 9 out of every 10 Americans will live in a city. In fact, they project that within this next decade, we will really have one large city that will run from Washington, D.C. to Boston, Massachusetts. And you will just cross city limit to city limit, but there really won't be a change in scenery. It will be one large city. I also just have recently read, interestingly, for those of you interested in missions, the latest demographics say that the largest mission field in the world is the northeastern corridor of the United States. There are more non-believers per capita in that corridor that we just described than there are any other pocket of the world. That's pretty frightening stuff. Urbanization continues to happen. A second change that we continually deal with is something we just mentioned there, and that's demographics, or the changing population within the group. And whether you believe it or not, there really are different segments within the population. The most popular ways to describe those are those that were born before the baby boom, before 1946, those that were born between 46 and 64, they're baby boomers, those that were born after 64, baby busters. Those are the three groups. Let me just tell you a little bit about the differences. The pre-boom people are basically hardworking folks. They believe in delayed gratification because most of them have either been through or experienced the remnant of the depression. And so they delayed gratification. Loyalty is a high, important value to them. They are very resistant to change, and they like command leadership style. They give and receive orders well. Well, now let's talk about baby boomers, 46 to 64, which probably are most of us in this room. Baby boomers have been described as the pig in the python. Did you ever watch Channel 12 and the snake eats a big animal? And you kind of watch it go through the snake's body, right? That's the baby boom phenomenon. As the baby boomers, that large group of people, go through the python, they change all structures as they approach it. And so when we were all in elementary school, they were building elementary schools all over the place. They couldn't build enough. Then they were building junior highs. Then they were building high schools. Then they were colleges. Well, now the pig has gone through the college python. Now college admissions people are getting laid off and getting into a lot of trouble, and they're wondering why they can't attract the students. Well, part of the problem is the pig has gone through the python. And so maybe those people really aren't there. The characteristics of this group are very different. Low loyalty. In fact, church to a baby boomer is just kind of a way station on one's ongoing spiritual journey. In fact, we see a phenomenon in our day, and those of you who go to church even around here, you see it, where individuals may say they belong to two or three churches. And depending on who's speaking, when they get up, what they feel like, they'll go to church A, B, or C. That makes all the sense in the world to a baby boomer. Now, to a pre-boomer, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, why don't you just be committed, right? It's a difference. They also have high expectations. They have greater education. Their greater education has caused greater degrees of expectation. They are used to things being done with excellence. And so they demand excellence in others, and they push themselves pretty hard to achieve it. They are low on the whole relational scale, though. They are not high relational type people. They have a great tolerance for diversity. They're willing to live with people that are different, who believe differently. You don't have to line up and get all your same ducks in the row. You can still hang out together and have a good time together. They're comfortable with change, and they prefer hands-on leadership. Well, now let's talk about baby busters, 65 and after. Baby busters have a sense of entitlement. The world owes them something. There's a lack of deferred gratification. Individualism and isolationism is kind of the rule. They're so used to being in their baby boomer's shadow that they want to do things to stand out. Now, here are the big ones. They are comfortable with contradictions. Baby boomers are basically consistent. Baby busters are basically inconsistent. When Leif Anderson was here, he talked about the three groups by telling a story. And he said, suppose you're driving down the street in Manhattan, and therefore you're going pretty slow. But as you're driving down the street, you look on the pavement, and you see this person walking on the pavement. The person has a three-piece pinstripe Brooks Brothers suit on. He has a ponytail, a diamond stud earring, and a pair of Reebok running shoes. He's carrying a leather briefcase, very expensive, with a sticker on it that says, "Save the Animals." Now, when the baby busters ride by, they look at the person and say, "Oh, look, he's going to work." Right? Contradiction. Sneakers, pinstripes, ponytails, diamond studs, a leather briefcase, save the animals. So what? All makes sense. Live with contradictions. If you want to see that, watch MTV. The soundtrack and the video track often are totally unrelated, but it doesn't matter. You can live with contradictions. Now, if two baby boomers ride by, they look and see the same guy. The guy becomes angry, and he says, "You know, I wish he would just be one thing or the other, all right? If he wants to wear sneakers, then he should wear a jogging suit and ditch the briefcase. If he wants to wear the suit, he should buy a pair of wingtips and cut the ponytail. Just be one thing or the other, right? Consistent, but willing to live with difference." When the pre-boomers ride by, they sense anger. In fact, every fiber of their being cries for them to get out and cut that ponytail and rip that diamond stud out of his ear and tell him to lose the shoes. Because they are consistent and they want others to get in step with their consistency. Now, why are we talking about demographics and groups of people? Because my hunch is that you have all three of those groups in your church. And those differences are real. And those changes are real. And as baby boomers have gone through the pig in the python deal, it makes a difference in how we think, doesn't it? And we can't understand very well the other groups of people, but the generations continue to change. And as we change and our experiences change, it demands that things are going to change as well. Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about leadership for just a second. And you'll see why that background on change is so important. Let me first of all give you a definition. I put a little triangle on your paper because I've read probably hundreds of definitions of leadership, but here's probably the most simple one that I think gets the point across in clearest fashion. A leader is a person. Right? Profound, isn't it? Who influences people to accomplish a purpose. Leadership is going up and down. A leader is a person who influences people to accomplish a purpose. Now, here's the tricky part. A leader is not someone who accomplishes a purpose. That person may be successful, but he's not a leader. You see, being a success and being a leader are two very different things. Being a success is a person accomplishing a purpose. Being a leader is influencing people to accomplish a purpose. There's a big difference. You see, being a leader means you're not content to just drive the bus to the destination. You want to make sure the people are on it with you. And quite frankly, a lot of times, it's a lot easier to just drive the bus to the destination. And if you've ever tried to wash a car with kids, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, it is a lot easier to just go wash the car, but that's not leadership. Leadership is influencing people to accomplish a purpose. When you confuse those things, you don't understand leadership. Leadership is then person influencing people to accomplish a purpose. Therefore, leadership, by definition, is not a maintenance role. It can't be. There is no leadership necessary to maintain status quo. Leaders influence people to accomplish a purpose. If the purpose is accomplished, then leadership to keep it that way is unnecessary. But here's the point that I want to bring in about change. You may need to follow this. Because things keep changing, we have to keep changing things to really change things. Right? You get that? Because things keep changing, we have to keep changing things to really change things. You see, if your church, and we'll use church, if your church and its strategies were very effective 50 years ago, we need to honor that past, but we also need to recognize that that probably means those same strategies are not going to be as effective today because things have changed. And if things are changing, then we need to keep changing things to really change things. That means that in order to maintain your same effectiveness level today, there must have been change from what you did yesterday. And if you're going to be effective tomorrow, even to the degree you are today, there will have to be changes tomorrow because our world is changing around us between today and tomorrow. So change is not optional for a leader. Change is part of what leadership is all about. Well, then, how do we navigate that? Well, how we navigate it, I just want to spin out some components, and I'm sorry we don't have a whole lot of time to talk about each of these, but I'll just spin them out, and maybe during a question-answer time, we can come back to the ones that you would like to revisit. We finish about 9, Doc, and then some Q&A after that? Okay. The first component, to clarify the vision. Vision is nothing more than seeing a desirable future. That's all that vision is. Seeing a desirable future. Painting a picture of a better tomorrow. That's all it is. I mean, it's not that profound or complex. It's just envisioning a better tomorrow. The real trick to developing a vision in ministry is to make sure that it's God's vision, which means developing vision must be under the umbrella of a maintained relationship with God. And it will be done in the midst of Bible study. It will be done in the midst of culture and people study. It will be done in the midst of great prayer. It will be done in the midst of conversation. It's not something that we just come in with and dump on the table. It's something that collectively happens as we seek God's will for a desirable future tomorrow. Now, you may say, what does a vision do, though? Well, a vision does a number of very important things. Number one, vision attracts people. And here's the key. The right people. You can have an organization, you can have a ministry, you can have a church that really does not have a specified vision. It's kind of general, vague, non-existent, whatever. And you will attract people. The right people and the wrong people. But without a vision, you have no way of determining which are the right and the wrong people. For example, it's kind of like getting on a bus or getting on an airplane, and you're not quite sure where the plane's going, and nobody else is either. Well, how do you know the right people that are on the plane and the wrong people that are on the plane? You don't, until somebody puts the destination up on the board. As soon as the destination is put up on the front of the plane, all of a sudden, everybody knows the right people and the wrong people. But without the sign that tells you where the plane's headed, there's no way of knowing the right people and the wrong people. And I think that a lot of times what ministries seek to do is to have open doors to everyone. So their modus operandi becomes being everything to everyone, which means they maintain a constant undercurrent of tension and criticism in the ministry. Because every methodology that's used, every strategy, every stylistic element of ministry, everything that's presented, every program that is there, some people like and some people dislike. And without a big vision to kind of say where we're headed, there's no way of really knowing where are the right people and where are the wrong people and where you draw the line. I was down in Washington the first couple of days of last week, and I was there with a couple other pastors, and we were doing a little conference. And it was almost comical. But after the one session on Tuesday morning, this guy came up to me and he said, I'm a layman in our church. And he said, as you were speaking and the other guys were speaking, he said, I feel like going home and grabbing my pastor by the lapels. And I feel like saying to him, now listen to this. Put a target on the wall. Any target, any wall. Just put a target on the wall. You see what he's saying? He's saying, my pastor says all the time, we need you to commit more money. We need you to commit more time. We need you to commit more energy. He said, I keep saying, why? Just show me the target and I'll commit. Tell me why and I'll give what you want. But if I don't know where the target is, I'm not sure what success is. And that really is the second thing. Vision attracts people, the right people, and vision defines success. How do you know what success looks like? Most Christians don't know. You don't know what success looks like because you don't know the destination. It's kind of like having a map in front of you, not knowing where you are, not really knowing where you're going. You don't have a vision. You're just kind of driving around. There are a lot of ministries like that today. There are a lot of ministries that are doing laps, spending a lot of energy, time, resource. They're just doing laps, though, because the destination has not been spelled out. If the destination is not spelled out, you cannot define success. Sometimes I like to go and watch little kids play soccer. If any of you have ever seen that, that's quite an adventure. I particularly like, 5 and 6-year-old soccer games. They don't play position. They all play the ball. I mean, it's a major accomplishment to keep the goalie near the net. It's like a giant amoeba running around the soccer field. All these kids around the ball. And it's not uncommon after the game to have the kids come over and say, Daddy, who won? Right? It kind of resembles ministry a lot often, doesn't it? They haven't defined success. They don't know what it means to put the ball in the net. So since there's not the vision, success cannot be defined. Since success cannot be defined, we just become busy. Activity and accomplishment are two very different things. You can only have accomplishment if you know what success is. You can only have success if you have a vision, you know where you're headed. So without a vision, success and the right people become almost arbitrary. Let me just say one more thing about vision. Vision gives you a basis to allocate resources. Ministry is all about allocating very limited resources to an unlimited need. Ever feel like that? Limited resources to really unlimited need. How do you make any sense out of that? You can't. Unless you have a game plan, and you can't have a game plan without a vision. And so the vision helps you say yes and helps you say no. And without some sense of where you're headed, you can't make those resource calls. And so we're often stuck. Every decision is a crisis decision, right? Because the big picture, the long-range view, has not been shown to people. What does vision kind of look like? I often think of architects when I think of vision. Architects are pretty amazing guys. On a couple of occasions, I've had opportunity to work with them. They're a little strange, but they're really impressive. They do stuff like this. You walk into a field, and they'll say, now, if you come on over here, this is where the main auditorium is going to be. Now, we're in a field, right? Now, if you come over here, these are where the offices are going to be. Oh, you can't go that way. See, there's a wall there. You have to go through the door, which is over there. You see, that's how architects do things. You see, the architect has the vision in his head, right? He knows what that thing looks like. He can then draw it. I need more than the drawings, really. But I can get some sense for it when I see the drawings. And when I begin to see the thing going up, then I'm beginning to catch the picture. That's how most people are. Most people can't just see it. They need to see the drawings. Now, I don't think you take out your pen necessarily. That's why in casting vision, and we're really moving into two, communicating vision, it's so important to use pictures and illustrations to tell stories. Because when you tell a story and a person finally gets it, they say things like, oh, I see it. Yeah, and what they really mean is now they see it. For most people, they need the drawings. Some people are never going to see it until the thing's built. But the vision guy, the leader, has to be the person who seeks the will of God and can envision tomorrow, a better, desirable future. And after doing that, he works at communicating that vision. Now, how does he communicate it? Well, I think obviously there need to be formal times of communication. You know, times when you sit down and say, okay, here's where we're headed, folks. Here's the next hill we need to take. If we want to get to point B, we've got a hill in the way. Here's the first hill we need to take. Now, again, he needs to get ownership. And one of the things that I often talk about, once the leader or someone, it doesn't have to be the point person, but once the vision has come to an individual, that individual needs to go to a group, a leadership group, a core group, a team, whatever you want to call it. The team must put their fingerprints on the vision. That's my term. What I mean by that, they need to make changes to it. Because when you come out of that meeting, it can't be his vision. It's our vision. I will force them to make changes. Even if it's one word, if it's one syllable, if it's one door frame in the picture, they have to make changes. So when we leave, it's ours. Then you need to communicate it widely, sometimes in formal sessions, a couple times a year. At our church, we have two formal times a year, two Sunday morning, two Sunday night, when our vision is repeated over and over. Some people have heard this vision for the last 4 years, four times a year. You know, sometimes when I come down from talking about the vision, I feel like apologizing to those folks. Say, I'm sorry you heard it again. That is almost never their side. Their side is, you know, thanks for the reminder of why we're in this. You know, I just signed up for another term. I mean, I'm ready to go because I know the destination again. I needed to hear it again. Because I get beat up and I lose focus, I lose sight, I need to hear it regularly. Thanks a lot for doing it again. It's incredible how often you need that. But how else do we do it? Here's an important way. You make heroes. Now don't misunderstand. When you make a hero, you kind of lift someone up, you know, and give them a word of affirmation. The problem is that very often in ministries, and in churches in particular, we make heroes indiscriminately, right? We just pick somebody and say, oh, he did a good job, so let's make him a hero. At this time of the year, many seminary students who graduate will go home. Their churches will make heroes out of them, right? They'll have them stand up. They'll have a reception for them downstairs, and that is a good thing. Make heroes on purpose, not by coincidence. Who are the heroes that I want to make at our church? And I'll be right up front. I'll tell you who they are. If I have to tell an illustration in a sermon and I have to make a hero, I'm going to make heroes of small group leaders. Because we want small groups to be the lifeblood of our church. I'm not going to make a hero, forgive me, of some Bible student who's really just a Bible junkie, or a knowledge junkie. He's not engaged in ministry. He's not really living, but he's the Bible answer man. We're not going to make a hero out of him. We're going to make a hero out of somebody who's using their knowledge in ministry, as they develop skills, and their character is reflecting the knowledge that they believe. Make heroes on purpose. That's how you cast vision. We often great heroes. We'll do interviews. We interview people on a regular basis in a Sunday morning service that have come to the Lord through the ministry. And the Lord's been good and has blessed us with a lot of those folks in the last few years. When we interview them, we specifically say things like, "Now, how did you first hear about Jesus and the fact that he really is interested in forgiving you your sin? How'd you hear about that?" "Well, I heard about that from Bob and Sue. That's how I heard about it." "How did Bob and Sue do that?" "Well, they just invited us for dinner and became our friends. And after a while, you know, that we noticed their lives were different. We asked them questions. They shared how they came to Christ and what their life was like before. And we started to come to church. We got in a small group. We go to the Adult Bible Fellowship. And, you know, it was really through that relationship." That's making the right kind of hero, right? So you make heroes, and that's how you cast vision. So you need a vision, and then you need to communicate it. And the way you do that is formal times, and you make heroes on a regular basis. Do things on purpose. Thirdly, establish core values. Most churches really have the same basic mission. I mean, at least I hope they do. There's not a whole lot of competing missions in the Bible. The Bible mandates, the biblical mandates for your church are the same as the ones for mine. So when it comes to the biblical mandates and for the central purpose and mission of the church, our mission statements can read the same. Where distinctives are found are in core values. Which means you take some of those biblical principles and you lift them up or you emphasize them. I have a sheet here that has our purpose, our core values, our strategy, and what our goal is. And you can pick one of those up. Our core values make us distinct, and the spin-offs of the core values determine what strategy is going to look like. For example, one of our core values is that lost people matter to God. That's a core value. Which means we want to respect non-Christians. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't tell them that they're sinful and that they need a Savior. That's not respecting them, right? Because if you really respect them, you point out the problem they have and the fact that if they don't get this right, they're in for an eternal nightmare, right? So that's not respecting them. You want to respect them, so you tell them the truth. But that means we're going to be careful about how we do things. For example, we don't have, I don't want to upset everybody. We don't have King James prayers at our church. You know, with like these and thous and betwixt and stuff. Because I don't think that communicates that non-Christians matter to God. I mean, after all, if you invited a friend over to your house and you sat down and your friend speaks English, it wouldn't show respect to talk Korean. Well, you know, to people who don't understand Elizabethan English, that doesn't show respect to speak a language that they don't understand. If lost people matter to God, that means we're going to do things to help them understand what's going on. And so we typically say, are minor things, right? But they make a little pretty big difference. We say things like, and this Sunday I'm speaking in the morning on Romans 8, and so I'll say something like, this morning we're going to look at the end of a section of a letter that Paul wrote to Christians in Rome. It's a long letter, probably a longer letter than any of you ever wrote. I mean, it has 16 chapters in this letter. And right in the middle of this letter, he's got this great section, and we're going to look at some of those verses today. And so if you would, take your Bible. If you didn't bring a Bible today, reach into the pew rack in front of you, grab that Bible. It's a little black book there. Take it out and turn to page 975. And if you look on the right-hand side of page 978, you see those little numbers in there? Those numbers are just verses. They help you find stuff. We're going to start at verse 31 and read through verse 39. Now, did that tick off any Christians? I don't think so. But I'll tell you what, for somebody who never opened a Bible before, but whose friend invited them to that service, that showed respect, right? Because now they're not trying to find Romans. Wonder where that's at for 40 minutes while you're finishing the message. Little things like that. Your core values highlight your distinctives. We have things like in our core values that small groups are the best places to grow Christians. That means that's our core value. So that means our ministry, our lifeblood for ministry is small groups, which means we're going to make heroes out of small group leaders. That means we're going to talk about small groups positively. We're going to channel people into them. Now, I'm not saying your church has to have our core values. I'm not saying your church has to have our same strategy. All I'm saying is you need a vision. You need to know where you're headed, and you also need to communicate that, and you need to have some core values. And you also need to have a strategy to get to the vision. How are you going to get there? There are a lot of ways to get from here to Philadelphia. I mean, I grew up in Center City. There are a lot of ways to go. There's no easy way. But there are a lot of different ways. You can get on 463, go down to 309 and hook a right and go all the way down 309 to Cheltenham Avenue and either go through and down Broad Street, or you can make a left, go down Cheltenham Ave and cut over through Rising Sun, or you can get on, and here's what I've been doing lately, go back and get on the Northeast Extension, get on the Blue Route down the Schuylkill Expressway, Vine Street Expressway, you're in Philadelphia. It's quick. A lot of different ways. Is one way better than the others? It depends. It depends what hour of the day. If it's Friday afternoon about 5 o'clock, we don't go the Schuylkill way. We would go the 309 way. And that isn't a great way, but that's an okay way. If there's an accident on 309, we may go the 95 way. Is one better than the other? No, they're just different. I think the church methodology, strategies are kind of like that. They're just different ways to get to the goal. Now, we've defined, and you'll see this on the sheet, we've defined success. And success for us at Calvary Church is, what does a mature believer look like? Now, we like that Ephesians 4 stuff. I like that. So we're going to talk something about relational, doctrinal, and functional maturity. We have four tests of a faithful follower of Christ. So here's our goal. Number one, he participates in worship. Number two, he lives the word. Number three, he contributes to the work. And number four, he impacts his world. Now, could you say that better? Sure, you probably can. It took us about 18 months to come up with that. And you can tell how bright we are. But this sheet that I'll hand out, this is about 2.5 years worth of work right here. Because everything has been agreed on, our vision, our core values, everything's here. That's our target. Now, how can you get there? You can get there a ton of different ways. Our strategy probably will be a little different than yours, and that's fine. That's fine. I'm convinced that the Lord uses all kinds of different churches because there's a whole lot of different people that need to be reached and need to grow up. So rather than point accusing fingers at other churches that use different styles, I think we need to appreciate the differentness that God gives to church bodies, just as we should appreciate the differentness and the uniqueness that God's children have. One of the problems we have as individual Christians is we don't like our gifts. We want somebody else's. We want to be like them. We don't like them because they're not like us. Churches do the same thing. We need to appreciate our differences and thank the Lord for those differences, because those differences provide balance. Those differences cause a greater impact. That's true for churches too. But so often today, churches evaluate other churches, ministries evaluate other ministries on the basis of whether they do things the way we do things. Style, methodology, in my mind, should show great freedom. I'll just mention for our church, we have basically a contemporary style. We have a band in the morning. We have drama every service. We have, we don't sing out of the hymn book. We don't, pray King James prayers in the morning. We don't do that kind of stuff. If your church wants to do that, that's fine. I was involved in starting a church in New York. In starting that church, we had a very traditional, high liturgical kind of church. I mean, we found out the right colors to put on the pulpit at the right time of the year. You know, we had a lot of Christian symbolism around, a lot of different, images and things that communicated to that group of people. Again, the question is, where do you want to go? Who are you trying to reach? And how are you going to get there? And if you know those three things, you're basically understanding leadership. Leadership is knowing where you are, knowing where you want to be, and strategy is finding out how you're going to get from here to there. That's all it is, developing a strategy. Well, how do you do that? Well, there's a lot of complex ways. We don't have time to talk about most of them. Let me just show you a chart that we use pretty regularly. We don't have time to explain a whole lot of it, except to say here are some things that actually need to be discussed. You need to examine your internal environment. And if you can't read it, that's okay. Just understand this is internal environment. You also need to look at your mission and your philosophy. You need to look at the external environment. Those three things should formulate a list of strategic issues. That list of strategic issues need to be prioritized. The prioritization of those strategic issues become your selected issues, and when you arrange them both chronologically and functionally, you really develop your process, or I would say your strategy for ministry. So all it is understanding who you are on the inside, what the world's like on the outside, right? Where you are, where you want to be, right? You want to be where God wants you to be, which means some of these people are going to be part of that, because part of his goal is reaching people. What's your mission? Those, the combination of those three things creates strategic issues, selected issues, and as that works out, you should come up with a strategy. An easy way to do this, we talk about doing SWOT analysis a lot. SWOT. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. Strengths and weaknesses are in your internal environment. What strengths do you have and what weaknesses? If there's one thing that I think every one of us as individuals and as organizations that we represent would greatly impact our effectiveness would be, number one, if we faced problems honestly. If the youth program stinks, say it stinks. Don't say, well, it's okay. It's getting better. If your pastor isn't a good preacher, say he isn't a good preacher. Face issues honestly. Because if you continually sweep them under the rug, they're never going to be dealt with. If you don't have a vision, say you don't have a vision. If you don't communicate the vision that you have, say it. So if you face the issue, secondly, if you get the right people around the table to talk about the issue and develop a plan, and thirdly, if you implement a plan, our lives would be drastically different and our churches and ministries would be a whole lot more effective. Face problems honestly, get the right people around the table and develop a plan, and thirdly, execute the plan. And if you do those three things, I guarantee you, your ministry will drastically change for the better. Just doing those three simple little things. You'll find, often as you do that, that the plan you originally developed may not be the right plan. But at least you have a plan to deviate from and to develop another plan. But if you never go through the process, you stand little chance of ever getting there. So you develop a strategy. Number five, you inspire and motivate people. Let me say this. The first four of those items that we just mentioned, we just finished number four. The first four of those really should comprise your philosophy of ministry. Your philosophy of ministry is nothing more than your vision, the communication of that vision, your list of your core values, and the strategy to get there. If you have those four things, you have a philosophy of ministry. That's what it is. Just put it on paper. Start talking about it and communicating it, and then inspire and motivate people. People are excited about vision. People will give to a vision. People will give their time and energy and resources and all that stuff. We need to move quickly. Number six. I really wanted to emphasize the first four anyway, so it's not like we're cheating. We need to empower and mobilize people. Which means you need to delegate. You need to let people own their share of accomplishing your vision. You can't do it all. You need to give everybody a piece. Now, here's what I would say. You need, to mobilize people, and I talk a lot about this at church, and we did some of this in class, so for some of you, you're going to be bored for a minute. We talk a lot about mobilizing people and empowering people on the basis of their shape. S-H-A-P-E. S is spiritual gifts. H is heart. Maybe you understand that better as passion. We just needed an H. A is abilities. P is personality. Or temperament. And E is experience, particularly spiritual experience or their maturity level. People need to be mobilized according to their shape. Why? Because God shaped them. Therefore, we need to empower people and mobilize people and give them authority according to their shape. Here's an architectural principle. Form follows function, right? You have to know what kind of building you want before you build it. If you want to build a school, you build that differently than building a mall. You build a mall differently than a house. You build a house differently than a seminary. You have to find out what you want before you build it. In ministry, that principle is wrong. I'm convinced in ministry, function should follow form. Because it's Jesus who's building the church. Therefore, the primary question in mobilizing people should be, how did God form these people? What's your shape? What spiritual gifts do you have? What are your passion areas for ministry? What are your abilities? What do you do well? What's your temperament like? What experiences do you have? What kind of maturity level do you have in doctrine, function, and relationship? How does all that work together? On the basis of your shape, you should be mobilized. Which means you don't mobilize people to fill a job description. You write the job description to mobilize the individual. We often follow the architectural principle rather than the ministry principle. What shapes of people did God give you in ministry? That's step one. What's your personality as a church? Who are the individuals that are here? What do they do well? What are their passion areas? What are their spiritual gifts? Deploy them in those areas. After all, if Christ is building a church and he gave you those people, he didn't make a mistake. Your ministry should be based on the shape of the people that God gave you presently. And as other people are attracted and won and they begin to develop and grow, you'll be given other shapes. And your ministry should grow according to the shapes of the people that God gives. I mean, that makes sense, right? Here's a real problem that I see, and if I haven't alienated some, I'll try now. I think one of the main liabilities in most churches is that churches are trying to be led by teachers rather than led by leaders. And churches are being taught by administrators. And churches are being administrated by managers. And on it goes. Now, doesn't it make sense? In the best of all worlds, wouldn't it make sense that leaders lead and teachers teach and administrators administer? Who would have ever thought of something like that? I would say that's how Christ is building a church. Spiritual gifts are not just an addendum to how we should be doing ministry. Our shape isn't just something that we talk about theoretically. Our shape is something that we need to come to grips with and understand and then work in the area of our giftedness and our shape. And we'll be much more effective. And we won't spend most of our time as leaders trying to keep people motivated and pumped up and enthused to do ministry because they'll be serving in their passion area. We'll be holding the reins to keep them back rather than whipping them to get them to move. But how do we often do it? Well, here's how I've experienced people doing it. It's late August. You need a junior high Sunday school teacher. Nobody volunteers because you lost the last three. They're in the cemetery. So there are no volunteers. But there's this new person. You know, he's been coming and he's been a faithful guy. And so you approach him and you say, you know, Bob, you ever think about teaching junior high boys? No, I hate junior high boys. Yeah, but you know, we really need a junior high teacher for a boys class. And you really love Jesus, don't you? I just thought I'd ask you. Yeah, well, I love Jesus. Well, we think that you need to teach junior high boys, and your love of Jesus could overflow into their lives, and you could really have an impact. Well, what happens, he's not passionate about that area. He may not have gifts in that area. He may not have the temperament for that. Maybe he's going to kill some of the boys. He may not have the spiritual maturity level to pull it off, but we deploy him to do it. We don't give him tools. We don't give him resources. We set him on his way and lock him in the room. You know, after a few months of getting beat up in that junior high room, what have you basically done? You've basically said to him, he says to you now, any amount of guilt you lay on me now will never get me to commit to anything again. You may lose him entirely. If not, you'll at least lose his service. I think that we made a tactical error when that happens. We need to find out his shape. Deploy him according to his shape. That makes sense. Number seven, I'm just going to mention these last few. Intercept entropy in its earliest stages. Every athlete knows that momentum is a real phenomenon. Is that the right word, Diana? Entropy? No. I would say this. Everything in ministry is in a constant state of decay. Why? Because of sin. So it's all decaying. So what do we have to do? We have to keep positive momentum. How do we do that? We do that by allocating resources strategically. The only kind of resources we have are dollars, people, square footage, and equipment. That's all we've got. We need to allocate those limited resources to intercept entropy. You know, a lot of churches wait till they get on the downward side of the curve, when the momentum has shifted against them. You know, it is a hard job to push a car uphill. It's an easy job to push a car downhill. Well, when a church starts going down and you want to push it back up, it takes a lot of resource to get that thing moving uphill. Doesn't it make sense to try to keep it moving on the positive side? The leader looks down the road. One of his jobs is to look down the road and to be continually assessing what changes may bring drastic entropy into being and cause ministry to stall. And he allocates resources strategically to intercept that. Number eight, he catalyzes for change. You're beginning to see, I think, that leadership's all about change. And bringing tomorrow here through a strategy. Number nine, I would say take risks and use your mistakes. Do you ever notice how much more effective a football team is during a two-minute drill? There was a study done a few years ago. I was telling a class about this last week. Teams score twice as much during the two-minute drill than they do the rest of the game. They move the ball three times more effectively during the three-minute drill. Why? I think because they take risks. They do things that they may not do. I think that a leader takes calculated risks. What's one of the problems with churches being led by teachers? Teachers are not risk takers by nature. Teachers are analysts. Teachers need all of the data. They want all of the data. Every fiber of their brain cries for 100% of the data before they make a decision. But that never happens in a real world. You know, we're called on to make decisions when we have 30, 40, 50% of the data. That's tough. Teachers stall. They will resist because they want 100% of the data. Leaders need to be willing to take chances and to take risks and learn from your mistakes. At least you found out one way that didn't work. And number 10, stay the course. We've been in a pretty major philosophy change at Calvary Church for about the last 4 years. We had a five-year plan to transition our philosophy. We've got another few months to go. And our plan will basically be complete. Have there been hurts and pains? Sure have. In the early part of that transition, we lost 200 people. When you put a destination up on the board, people who don't want to go to that destination get off the airplane. So when a vision was put up, 200 people left. That's hard to take. Some people lost close friends, no longer go to church. But they were willing, the leaders were willing to say, this is what God's calling us to do. And if God's calling us to this vision, then we need to be willing to run with this vision. And if that means that we bleed a little because we're living on the cutting edge, then we need to bleed a little. I think that we've probably turned a corner. About last year this time, we just had a baptism this past Sunday night. But we had one last year, and we baptized, I guess it was about 44 people. Almost every one of those, and this was kind of the last hurdle for us, at least momentum-wise. Almost every one of those people that were baptized came to the Lord through Calvary Church. I don't say that to lift up our church or to say, because we have a lot of problems, and there are a lot of things that we need to deal with. But that kind of was the final nail in the philosophy discussion. What have we done? Nothing more than what I just said on your paper for you to do. We've done nothing more. Say, here's the vision. Here's where we're headed. Here are our core values. We're going to keep these things maintained as we go. We're never going to... These are going to be our distinctives. Here's our strategy to get there. If you want another strategy, that's fine. We'll help you find another church that has a strategy you like. That's fine. But here's our strategy. And we just move along, try to keep people energized and mobilized. We help people find their shape. We run seminars. And that, in fact, now to join our church, you have to go through a servant seminar where you learn your shape. And then you learn your shape, and that's compared with databases that we have, and we want to plug you into ministries that fit your shape. And the Lord has, I don't want to say use that, I think the Lord has helped develop that whole thing in happening. But I would say that only happens when people realize that change is a given. And since things are always changing, we're going to have to keep changing things to really change things. Because yesterday's methods and strategies are probably not going to be tomorrow's. What does a leader need to do? Keep the same biblical goals, because God's truth is unchanging. But methodology is ever-changing. Freedom of form, constancy of function. And as we walk that balance, seeking to reach a target and make a ministry happen, whether that's in a corporation, in a ministry, in a church, that's really what leadership is all about. knowing where you're headed, knowing where you are, and knowing how to get from here to there, rolling up a plan to get there. It's that simple.